Good to see all of you tonight. We've got a lot to talk about tonight. I've got just a little bit more I want to talk about concerning the questions on Lesson 33. And I wanted to ask you a question. Do you like having these questions to go over? Is it helpful to you to go over it again, or is it sufficient what we do in the class without the homework questions?
Okay.
You like the questions, okay. That's good. Then I can do those for each chapter when we finish with it. We can go over the questions. That'll be helpful to you then. Thank you for that. That's very helpful to me to know that. In our study tonight, if you would please open your Bibles to the... we're going to be looking some more in Jeremiah and also in Ezekiel and maybe just a little bit in Daniel. So if you have markers, you know me. Stickies do a wonderful job of marking the place where we're going to be talking. So we'll begin with some of that. We're going over the questions at the conclusion of Lesson 33 that have been handed out to you. And if you don't have a copy of them, they're on the board. Some of these we have looked at. We've talked about the Babylonians and noted that they were not as cruel as the Assyrians. It's important, I think, in history for us to note, and perhaps just to emphasize once again, what was it that was characteristic of the Assyrians that was not so pronounced among the Babylonians when they took someone captive? Pardon me?
They spread the people out in different places.
That's right, they did. They scattered them out. And of course, those of Judea could have saved, for the most part, put if they had done what? The Babylonians did not necessarily demand that they go into captivity. What was it that the people of the southern kingdom should have done?
Surrendered.
That's right. That's what Jeremiah the prophet told them to do, and they would not do so. In fact, what did they do? They went to Egypt to try to make an alliance with the Egyptians. And by the way, when we talk about alliances with the Egyptians, what was it that God had said long before they ever came into the promised land, long before they ever had a king, in fact, long before the period of the judges, period before Joshua even, through Moses, what was it that God had said to them about their allegiance to Egypt? Don't. Very simply put. And, of course, the text of that is found, I believe, in Deuteronomy 17, where they were not to make any league with the Egyptians. They were not to go back to the Egyptians and so forth. But they did time and time again. And as we see what was not uncommonly practiced during that era of time was to purchase the service of mercenaries from another nation or make an alliance with another nation. Number 9, who was in charge? I'm sorry, go ahead, Randy.
I was just going to mention that you mentioned Deuteronomy 17, verse 16 says, "Moreover, you shall not multiply horses for yourself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way."
Mm-hmm. That's the point.
God didn't want them to ever go back.
Don't ever go back to Egypt. No, but they did, time and time again. Jenny? Well, that's a good question. I haven't thought of that.
Well, this charge in Deuteronomy, I think it's talking about when they get a king.
Well, that's true. And let me think on that. I have not thought of that. I like to think on that a lot. Sometimes I hadn't thought of that question before. I think they were told by the angel to go because there were those who were seeking to kill their son. And so they were told to go.
Maybe it's because the people seeking to kill him wouldn't have gone to Egypt.
Perhaps. I just have to go back and read the text. Yes, Lynn? Or is it Luke 3?
No, it's Matthew 2.
Matthew 2, okay.
Verse 13.
Okay. Is that helpful? Yeah, it works. Okay. Number 9. Who was in charge of Babylon on the night God's handwriting on the wall pronounced Babylon's doom? Belshazzar. And, of course, he was not a very good character. What prophet was taken in the second group of captives in 596 B.C.? All right, Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. We want to note there that he was privileged to see a vision from God's perspective, a heavenly vision of the things that Judah was doing. And of course, I just answered that question. In chapter 8 through chapter 11, we noted one thing in particular, one specific thing that Ezekiel saw. What was it? Randy? That's right. He saw the glory of God over the city, and then he saw that removed to the mountains. The glory of God removed from his people. Number 12, we learn from Israel, the Israelite nation, that the promises of God are just as true concerning his punishment as they are concerning what? Which is the other side of it. His blessings. That's right. Now, we talked about his blessings and have throughout this series of studies, beginning actually in Genesis 3:15 with the first promise relative to the seed of woman bruising the head of the serpent, and then that repeated to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, repeated to Abraham again in Genesis chapter 22, repeated to Abraham's son Isaac, where? Genesis 26, and to Isaac's son Jacob, where? Genesis 28, yes. Now, you all are making a list of these passages. Hopefully, we go over them enough that that list will be permanently lodged right up here. All right? Now, we've talked about 2 Samuel 7, how that God promised David that he would establish his throne forever. And we see allusions to that in the Old Testament, fulfilled in the New Testament. When Jesus is exalted to the right hand of God, exonerated, if you please, to the right hand of God in Acts chapter 1, declared to be exalted to that place in Acts chapter 2. Number 13, Ezekiel's vision included God's promise that the faithful would one day do what? Return. That's right. One day they would go home. And of course, that's what many of them desired to do. Who prophesied that never again would there be a king of the royal line of David ruling or reigning in Jerusalem? We talked about that. Where is it? Jeremiah did. Anyone remember the chapter? Jeremiah. Okay. It's on the right-hand page. Right-hand column. Upper part of the page. In fact, it's from the bottom up to the top where it begins. No, it's 22, yes. Jeremiah chapter 22. Very good. One you need to remember. What were the dates in which the 70 years of captivity occurred? When was Jerusalem destroyed?
606.
All right, 606 to 536 B.C. And we note that Jeremiah had, in Jeremiah, I believe, 25, prophesied concerning the 70-year captivity, but also in Jeremiah 29 and verse 10. Now, that's the end of that. Do you have any question or comment just here? No? Anybody? Anything? I want to talk with you then about the Medo-Persian Empire. What we're going to do in the beginning of our study is we're going to look rather extensively at not only Bible history, but secular history to know some of the things that were going on during this period of time. Now, these passages that I have on the board are very important to this period of time. If you're making a list or making notes or writing down or making mental notes, you put these in there. Isaiah chapter 44 and 45. As chapter 44 concludes and you get into the first few verses of chapter 45, we read of Isaiah's prophecy concerning the coming of one by the name of Cyrus, who would write a decree and would allow the people of God to go home. Now, the book of Ezra, chapter 1, we're introduced to Cyrus, who was the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, and it's there that we can read of the decree that he wrote, and the lessons involved in those early chapters of the book of Ezra. You'll note that 2 Chronicles, when we talk about the account of the kings, 2 Chronicles concludes with these words about Cyrus, who would write a decree and allow these people to go home. Now, again, if you're trying to get things in order, we're going to revisit this. After the period of captivity, we read of Cyrus writing that decree, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, and the book of Ezra deals with that time frame. The book of Nehemiah deals with that time frame as Nehemiah returns to rebuild the walls, lead in the rebuilding of the walls around the city of Jerusalem, and also the book of Haggai. We'll talk about those in that period of the restoration. Haggai returned to lead the people in rebuilding the temple in the city of Jerusalem that had been torn down by King Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? So these are passages I'd like for you to put in your list to remember. Now, just a bit of review. We know that the Assyrians take Israel, and 721, our book says, some studies that I've done use the date 722. I won't fuss too much if you get it within a year. 721, 722 is where we're talking about. The Assyrians conquered the city of Samaria during the reign of whom? Who was the last of the kings in the northern empire? What was his name? Hoshea. Very good. Very good. And the Babylonians then take Judah. In 586, we see the first wave of captivity. And then, fall, rather, of Jerusalem. And then the Medo-Persians subdue Babylon. We're going to talk about that tonight. In the year 539 B.C. And then the Jews return to Jerusalem in 536 B.C. Now, if you go from 606 to 536, how long did that take? The first wave of captivity upon the southern kingdom, 606. And so we've got the dates and we're clear on that. The Jews were led in their return to Jerusalem by a man by the name of Zerubbabel. Notice, if you will, that he is listed in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1 and in verse 12. Now, let's back up just a little bit and talk about what happened to Assyria. We've noted that Assyria was a tremendous world empire. And when Israel fell to the Assyrians, notice, if you will, and I think it's important perhaps that we look at this, in 2 Kings chapter 17, that's a chapter you want to remember anyway. 2 Kings chapter 17, that represents the time when the northern kingdom fell under the leadership or the reign of Hoshea, Jenny, as you were pointing out. But in 2 Kings chapter 17, in verse 6, I knew that didn't look right. It says, in the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away unto Assyria and placed them in Hala and on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. Now talk to me about that. The Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom and they scattered them out. And notice, if you will, that some were placed in the cities of the Medes. What does that suggest to us was the relationship between, at this point at least, between Assyria and the Medes.
Well, the Assyrians were in control.
Yes, yes. And so if they took captives and they scattered them out over here among the cities of the Medes and these other places, it indicates that the Assyrians controlled the cities of the Medes.
They
had already conquered them. Yes. So let's remember that. In the 18th chapter of 2 Kings, the 18th chapter in verse 11, likewise it says, and the king of Assyria carried Israel away unto Assyria and put them in Hala and on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes, because they obeyed not the voice of God. Now what we see in that is Assyria is in control. They're the ruling entity, even over the Medes. But we see that Assyria could not hold that power and that position. What generally happens, and what do we see? Well, almost always happens. When one group of people subjugate another group of people. Do the people that are subjugated generally like it? Well, not usually. So what do they seek to do?
Overthrow them.
There's always the desire to overthrow or to at least gain independence over those who have conquered them. And Egypt was one of those. Now, we talked about how that Israel was not to make any alliances with the Egyptians, yet they did, and the Assyrians conquered both Israel and the Egyptians. But the Egyptians sought their independence from Assyria. And keep in mind, if you look at the map, and we'll do that in just a moment, that Egypt is on the southwestern edge of the rulership or the power of the Assyrians. And they wanted to be free. But the Medes, we'll look at the map and see exactly where they were. And you'll note that they were to the east and to basically simply to the east of the Assyrians, almost due east to the Assyrians. And they were over here growing in their strength and number. And then Babylon, to the south of Assyria, was constantly a thorn in the side of Assyria. So what's taking place? When we look even in the Transjordan Plateau and east over into the Arabian Desert, the Arab tribes came to plunder the lands of eastern Palestine and Syria. The nomadic tribes would in and out and take what they wanted for the most part. And so you see what's happening to the Assyrian Empire. Now, when Nabopolassar gained independence for Babylon, he joined forces with the Medes, and you see what happened. You've got the Medes who don't like being under the rule of the Assyrians, and you've got the Babylonians that don't like being under the rule of the Assyrians, and when they join forces, you've got a mighty power that caused Assyria to fall in 612 B.C., Now, Jenny, you very aptly answered a question that I asked Sunday, and that is, who made Babylon, the city of Babylon in particular, such a fabulous city? And our book answered that, Nebuchadnezzar. But you answered that, God did. Now, do you see God working in the movement of these nations behind the scene to bring the Babylonian Empire to be the dominant world empire? Now that's what's taking place. Now another decisive battle took place at Carchemish. We've got the Egyptians and the Babylonians fighting against Carchemish. And so what this does is it just dissolves or erodes the authority of the Assyrians. Now the Medes agreed, originally at least, to coexist with the Babylonians. Remember, they formed this alliance, so we're good to go. We're buddies. That generally doesn't last very long. The Medes was later taken by Cyrus, the king of the Persian Empire, who in turn added his name to this tiny little country to form the great Medo-Persian Empire. Now, it's interesting to note, and I think I have a map, yes, on this map, but I have another one. Here's the Caspian Sea. You have this map in your book. And here's the Sargos Mountains. And here's the Median Empire, where the Medes and the Persians eventually join forces, and it becomes quite an entity in the ancient world. Now, just a little bit further, they grew in strength until they became extremely large. Now, here's where they started out, over here. Here's where Cyrus started out.
So Persia is small.
Very small.
So it's just a little piece added to.
Just a little piece. And we'll talk about how he expanded up into here. His mother was the daughter of the king of the Medes. His mother was the daughter of the king of the Medes. Cyrus. Yeah. So he's down here. He's a Persian. But the king of the Medes up here has a Persian wife, just happened to be Cyrus' mother. Now, what do you think Cyrus wanted to do? He wants to take the kingdom, and he does. We'll talk about some of that as he conquers and comes over into actually the Lydian kingdom, and that's as far west as anyone has really ruled to this point. The Assyrians didn't go quite that far. Now, here are three maps laid side by side. The Assyrian Empire. Can everyone see? The Assyrian Empire is in the green. And we see that little pink dot. We've talked about that little pink dot before. David, what does that represent? Anyone? Judah. That little pink dot right there is Judah. Now, I've got a map that we're going to look at that'll make that bigger. What I want you to see is that here is the Assyrian Empire coming down into Egypt. It didn't reach all the way over into here. But what we do want to note is that that little pink dot is on the map during the reign of Hezekiah. And why? What was it that Hezekiah did during the onslaught of the Assyrians? Chris, you remember that? Hezekiah, one of the greatest kings of the southern kingdom.
Prayed to God.
All right, he prayed to God. We know that the Assyrian king basically made fun of the God of Hezekiah. And Hezekiah prayed to God that his making fun of would be turned back upon him. And what happened to the king of Assyria and his army? I like this part. What happened to his army? The day he began to charge Jerusalem,
185,000 died.
They died. That's right. So what did he do with his ball of yarn, Randy?
He rolled it up
and
went back home.
He rolled up his ball of yarn and went back home. And what happened to him when he got home?
His kids killed him.
His two boys killed him. That's exactly right. Yes.
By the way, if anybody's looking in the book, that's page 121.
Page 121, you'll see this map. Okay, excellent. I should put the page number on there. Sorry. I didn't. Here's the Babylonian Empire. And what you see here is Jerusalem, but you see the Babylonian Empire has just engulfed it. You don't see Assyria anymore because Babylon has conquered Assyria. Now that raises an interesting question. What about these captives that Assyria has taken over here? Where are they now? Yeah, the Babylonian king has control of those captives, as well as those that are taken from the southern kingdom, including Daniel, Ezekiel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're all captives in the Babylonian Empire. Now here's the great Medo-Persian Empire, and we see the extent of it. Now we might raise the question, which one is bigger?
Assyrian kingdom took the northern 10 tribes in the way here.
About 722, 721, depending on what source you read from.
And Babylon
took Jerusalem, finally conquering the city in 586 as the city of Jerusalem fell. But the first wave of invasion was in 606. That's when Daniel was taken. By Babylon, yes.
They didn't destroy Jerusalem, they just took captives, and that's when he got taken.
Yeah, yeah.
586 is when they came back.
It's when it fell.
So, we're talking about, trying to reverse math in my head, from 726 to 721 to, so there's over 100 years.
Yes.
Okay.
Roughly 135 years, thereabouts. Between, if I'm reading your question, between the time that the Assyrians conquered Samaria and the time that the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem, roughly 135 years. Yes. Now, that's such an interesting and intriguing topic. Do you think that you would be so familiar with your history 135 years before, that you wouldn't do the same things that they did? 135 years. See, we're talking about less than two generations. Less than two generations. And what are they doing? The very same thing. Yes, Jenny?
Well, we got to the period of the judges. The first judge was married to Caleb's daughter. So it's not like it was that long after Joshua and Caleb led them in.
That's right.
That they went in the first spiral.
Yeah, the very first generation. After Joshua and Caleb, right? Now, is there a lesson to be gleaned from that? Look at the Lord's church. There are some in the audience this evening that have been members of the church for a very long time. And I dare say, you just look back in your lifetime, just in your lifetime, you see that the Lord's church in many areas has drifted and drifted and drifted to the extent that perhaps you could say it doesn't bear the same identity that it did when you were much younger. I had a fellow call me yesterday, and he was wanting to know about the Fifth Street East Church of Christ. I said, anything you want to know, I'll be happy to tell you. And he wanted to know, how do we worship? Do we use instrumental music? I said, no, we don't do that. But there are some churches of Christ that do. He wanted to know if we observe the Lord's Supper upon the first day of the week. I said, yes, we do. But there are some that worship and observe the Lord's Supper just any time. I said, you might want to think about this as you're considering things about where you go to worship, that not all churches of Christ teach and practice the same things. And he said, yes, he was aware of that. Now, that's important. What are we looking at here? We're seeing that just from the lifetime of this man to his son, things were very, very different. Lesson taught, hopefully lesson learned.
Well, that's why Moses' admonition in Deuteronomy about teach your children all the time. You have to do that because we forget so fast.
That's right. That's right. Even within a generation, often we forget. Yes. All right. About the time that Nebuchadnezzar died in Babylon, about 562 BC, Cyrus comes to power. Now, we saw on a previous map this little spot over here, just a little obscure spot on the map, is where Cyrus is. And his mother was the daughter, and I might need some help in pronouncing that, Ataskes. Is that close? Somebody help me with that. Yes, right here. Who was ruling over Media up here. Well, right here. Okay. And so Cyrus is down there, and his mother is the queen. And so what is it that his desire is? He wants to take it. And so he does. He marches against his grandfather. And he takes the capital, Ecbatana, conquering it in 550 B.C., and he declared himself king. Now, I want you to look at, well, I already passed it. Look at this little map over here. Here's where he started out. And he conquers the capital. But look at what all that entailed. He declared himself king over the whole thing. Because he was. He conquered the king. Plus he had some followers. Yes, that's true. Now, the next point is that the Medes were given positions of honor. Now we want to take note of that because that becomes very prominent in a particular ruler that we're going to be talking about. Can anybody tell me what his name was? We talk about Cyrus as being the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, but there's another figure that is of great importance in the history of Israel.
Darius?
Not the one of... Did you say Darius? Yes, Darius.
Because he was a Mede.
He was a Mede. That's right. And that's her point. The Medes were given positions of honor, and Darius was one of them. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But many of the customs and the laws were combined with those of Persia. And so consequently, we have a blending of two empires, one really small and one very large, and Cyrus becomes then the king of what at this point is the largest empire that has existed in the world, the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, that's significant in our study of Daniel. You remember Daniel chapter 2, as Daniel begins with King Nebuchadnezzar and talks about a second kingdom and a third kingdom and a fourth kingdom. Well, after Babylon, what was the next kingdom? The Medes and the Persians, when they joined forces ruled over by Cyrus. And that's the point in time here that we're talking about. And this map represents the great Medo-Persian Empire that extends up here to Lydia and down here into Egypt. And, of course, this is the Arabian Desert. We don't generally count that necessarily, but that was not a part of his empire. And of course, here's where he started out. And now look what he's got. Great man, wasn't he? Okay, so he went from this, conquering the capital, to this, as you see on the board. Some other things I want us to think about. Cyrus turns his attention to Asia Minor. Now, I want to look back at our map over here. This represents Asia Minor, this area in here. And so we're going to talk about that, especially when we get into the New Testament text of various places and travels of the Apostle Paul, even as we talk about Macedonia, Achaia, or Greece, areas up in here. But here's where Cyrus is now interested, in Asia Minor. So he extends his rule all the way over into there. So he includes more territory than he has than has existed as an empire before. And then he moves against the Babylonian Empire, and he begins to eat away. And let me go back to our map. This great Babylonian Empire, you saw it existed down into here. So he has expanded his kingdom up to here, and now he wants to bring it down into here. And he does. And he conquers the great Babylonian Empire by eating away the northern Mesopotamian area of what we generally refer to as the Fertile Crescent. So he expands the empire. Now, that raises some interesting questions. What made that possible? This is interesting to me. What made it possible for Cyrus to be able to do that? Well, after Nebuchadnezzar died, Nabonidus of Babylon became the king, and he was not the king that Nebuchadnezzar was. In fact, he began to anger the priest. He became lax in his rule of the temple, and I have on the board that he had taken several trips over his empire. And what sometimes happens, as we used to say in Kentucky, when the cat's away, what happens? The mice will play, all right? What happened during the days of David when all the other kings were out to war and he should have been out taking care of business? Where was he? He was in Jerusalem, and things began to happen. Sometimes when we're not taking care of our duties and responsibilities, things happen. And Nabonidus had taken several trips over his empire. Now, interestingly enough, while he was out of town, what did Cyrus do? Everything's listed up there. You're good. All right, let's open our Bibles to Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5. In Daniel chapter 5, we've got Belshazzar reigning as king in Babylon, and he's the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. And what we want to note about him is he was not a, pardon me?
He wasn't related to Nebuchadnezzar.
He wasn't related? I've got some notes that says Belshazzar.
No, he calls Nebuchadnezzar. No.
Wasn't related at all to Nebuchadnezzar? I'll have to go back and restudy that.
Verse 2 says Nebuchadnezzar is
father.
Yeah.
I know that says that, but I believe that's just one of their hyperboles.
Well, now that's possible. We see a similar thought expressed in verse 11. I'll have to go back and rethink that.
My note in the margin says, or forefather.
Or forefather, yeah, that would indicate relation. But
Well, not necessarily. We talk about our forefathers of the nation.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. In terms of being of Babylonian descent. Okay. I'll go back and have to rethink that. But what we do want to know about Belshazzar, he's the one whose knees smote together when he saw the handwriting of God on the wall. And when the kingdom began to crumble, you'll look at the last portion of chapter 5, Daniel chapter 5, verse 30. It says, in that night Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps, who should be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them 3 presidents, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might give account unto them, and that the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was distinguished above the presidents and the satraps, and because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. Now, look carefully at that. We're introduced here to, or some discussion about Darius the Mede. Who gave Darius the Mede the position that he had? Cyrus the Persian. All right, that's right. What I want you to also notice is in this, what we refer to as the Medo-Persian Empire, is the span of Daniel's life. We might guess Daniel's age, and approximately around what, when they were taken, he and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, into Babylonian captivity?
Teenager,
probably. Yeah. He's described as a youth. And when we think about him now as being one of the presidents under the rule of Darius the Mede, approximately how old would you describe him?
70s.
Well, at least 70s, perhaps, and likely 80s, because his lifetime has spanned the captivity of 70 years. Okay? So that's, I think, helpful to us. He's getting to be, as we use the expression, on up there. But he's given a position of power and authority. Now, Cyrus was very much different from the Assyrian kings and even the Babylonian kings. We find during the reign of Cyrus, there were no mass killings. There were no characters carried off in chains like Zedekiah and having put his eyes out and cruel things such as that. And men of prominence in Babylon were given positions in this new government, and even from among some of the captives that the Babylonian Empire had taken, as we've talked about, Daniel and so forth, were given positions of power. Darius, under the instruction of Cyrus, was set up to be king over the new Persian province of Babylon. And what do we find that really marks a very noted difference between Cyrus' attitude of those that he conquered versus, for instance, the Assyrian kings? What did Cyrus want? What's on the board? What he wanted was a huge empire, but he didn't want the empire to be made up of slaves. What he wanted the empire to be was to be made up of independent nations, controlled by an emperor. Pardon me?
Taxpayers,
yes. So there could be commerce and trade and communication between these independent nations. And all, of course, would be under his thumb.
Make a lot more money doing that than trying to fight wars and have to supply armies.
Oh, yes. Well, most have said, and I think correctly so, at least from what I have read, that the very best kind of government that can exist is where you have a king, if you have the right king. Now that's the key. If you have the right king. At least at this point in history, Cyrus was the right king. This is what he wanted. He wanted nations to get along with each other and not to be warring and so forth, so he could benefit from the commerce would exist. Now the Jews in Babylon, they were pleased when Cyrus came to power. Daniel, as we've already noted, he was very much aware of the end of the period of captivity. Daniel was aware of the prophecy of Jeremiah, that this captivity was going to last for 70 years. And as we note in Daniel chapter 9, verse 1, and the verses following from verse 5, Daniel was aware that this period of captivity was almost over. Now, it's interesting to note just here, when we talk about the providence of God, how did Jeremiah know that the captivity was going to last only 70 years? He was a prophet. God told him such. Now, let's back that up a step. Back up, if you will, to Isaiah chapter 44 and 45. Isaiah chapter 44 and 45. Katie, you know when sometimes folks challenge, well, why do you believe the Bible? I find this interesting. This is one of the most powerful evidences that you can look at as far as internal evidence is concerned, is look at prophecy. This has created just all kinds of havoc in the religious world. When Isaiah prophesied in chapter 44, look if you will, beginning in verse 27, it says, that saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure. Even saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. Thus saith Jehovah unto his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of the kings, to open the doors before him, and the gates shall not be shut. Now there's just all kinds of interesting stuff in there. Number one, about what time did Isaiah write? About what time did Isaiah write? About 750 thereabouts. Was it before or after the conquering of the northern kingdom, the city of Samaria? It was before Samaria was conquered. Now, how long was it between the conquering of Samaria and the conquering of Jerusalem by the Babylonians? About 130 or so years. Now, from the conquering of the city of Jerusalem, backing that up to the time of Isaiah, about 750 or so B.C., how many years do we have, mathematicians in the family? From about 586 is when it finally fell, backing that up to 750, what are we looking at? Quick on the math, Jenny.
230.
About 230 years? Okay, there. I haven't done that, so I don't know the number. About 230 years? Okay. Now, shoot that forward. If you're not 230, what do we got? 160, 170?
750
to about 586.
Okay.
What have we got?
So less than 200.
Less than 200 years. Okay. Mathematician in the family. All right, now, let's do some more math. And this is not my strong point, so you all help me out. When we look at the time then that Isaiah prophesied from about 750 B.C. to the time of Cyrus, about how many years have taken place? From the time of Isaiah, about 750, to the time of Cyrus, when he became king and wrote this decree to let the people go. What year was the decree? All right. Babylon surrendered in 539.
That would be
over 200. It would be.
Yeah.
Over 200 years. Now, let's back up. What did Isaiah know about 200 years before the fact? What did he know?
Name of the man.
Name of the man.
Jerusalem would be rebuilt.
Yes, that Jerusalem would be rebuilt. And he knew that long before Jerusalem had ever been destroyed.
And the temple.
And then the temple would be rebuilt. What else did he know? Yeah. He knew that the river would be dried up and Babylon would fall. Now, what river was it? What do we know that Cyrus did? The river Euphrates. It's on the board, yeah. The river Euphrates, yes. Cyrus dug a trench around the city of Babylon, and then he diverted the water into the trench and just marched right up through the dry riverbed. And if you'll notice in Daniel chapter 5, one more time, those last few verses. Let's look at it. Daniel chapter 5.
So while you're turning, I'm just trying to picture this. I'm always trying to paint a picture of history to my students. So he's marched up to what city again? To Babylon?
Yeah.
And
Cyrus, yes.
So it's going to take him some time to dig that thing. So meanwhile, all the citizens are in there with no king there to tell them how to defend themselves.
Well, he's out there doing visiting his monarchy, you see, visiting his thing. So, in a very real sense, yes. Yeah.
And wasn't it that Belshazzar knew about the 70 years and he was waiting for something to happen, and according to his timeline, it didn't happen, and that's why he had this great big old party for however long he had this big old party, and so they were kind of not even prepared.
No.
Because he thought God wasn't going to do anything.
No. No.
Because it's been too long.
Been too long.
I've never saw. God's not good. It makes me think of Saul. Well, you know, Samuel's not coming, so I'll just take it in.
Yeah. Not going to happen. So I want us to be impressed with that. Now, you know what that's caused some people to do, some religious scholars, as they call themselves? They say that the text of Isaiah chapter 40 on to the end of the chapter, or end of the book, well, that wasn't written by Isaiah. That was written by somebody else, and we don't know who, but guess when they say it was written?
After the events happened.
After the events happened. You know why they say that? Because Isaiah just could not have known the specifics of the details 200 years before. Well, now, understanding that there is a God, and understanding that Isaiah was a prophet, tell me why he couldn't know that. Does that argue for the validity of the Scriptures?
If you're going to do that, you might as well take God.
You see, what we've got, Carolyn, is we've got a parallel between world history and Bible history. And it lines up. So we just can't explain now that Isaiah was inspired of God to do that, because after all, you see, we don't believe there's a God. So somebody else had to write Isaiah, and after the fact. Jenny? That's right. Circular reason. Yeah, circular reason. All right. Good class. Thank you.